Good morning, this is AM. I'm Simon Santo. Authorities are hoping to find out later today just what happened to missing AirAsia flight QZ8501. The Airbus A320 plane disappeared from radar screens 24 hours ago while on a short flight from Surabaya in Indonesia to Singapore. Boats have been searching for any sign of wreckage throughout the night, while an air search will resume when dawn breaks later this morning. 155 passengers and 7 crew members are on board the flight. The pilot had requested permission from air traffic control to fly higher to avoid bad weather. This report from Michael Edwards.
A crisis centre has been set up at Juanda Airport in the Indonesian city of Surabaya, the place where Indonesia AirAsia flight QZ8501 took off from. Dozens of anxious friends and family members of those on board are waiting at the airport, desperate for any news of what's happened to the plane. Some scrolled through the passenger list, hoping that their relatives had missed the flight or had got on a different plane. One man, Purnomo, was set to be on flight QZ8501 with his friends, but he'd cancelled because of work commitments.
I hope for a miracle and may God save all of them. I should have gone with them, but I cancelled it 2 weeks ago as I had something to do. I have 2 friends and they went with 5 family members.
Flight QZ8501 was between the Indonesian port of Tanjung Pandan and the town of Pontianak in West Kalimantan province on Borneo Island when it went missing. No distress signal was detected. Indonesia AirAsia says 155 of those on board are Indonesians. Indonesian officials say the aircraft had been flying at 32,000 feet and had asked to fly at 38,000 feet to avoid bad weather. According to aviation experts, there is nothing unusual about this. Mike Robertson is an aviation expert based in Sweden who runs a company, Flight Radar 24.
The most common reason to avoid such weather is so passengers are not feeling so bad, that don't need to experience the turbulence.
Indonesia AirAsia says both the pilot and co-pilot are vastly experienced and the plane had been serviced only a few months ago. Indonesia AirAsia is 49% owned by Malaysia-based budget carrier AirAsia, with local investors holding the rest. The AirAsia group, including affiliates in Thailand, the Philippines and India, has not had a crash since its operations began in 2002. Neil Hansford from Strategic Aviation Solutions says the airline is well regarded for its safety record.
The aircraft fleet is very young. This aircraft was only 6 years old. The average fleet in Indonesian AirAsia is 3.6 years, so that's a very young fleet of Airbus 320s.
What is intriguing to experts such as Neil Hansford is why no distress signal was sent out.
Any twin-engine aircraft of this type is quite capable for flying for 60 to 90 minutes on one engine to give you time to make a diversion. Even if he'd lost an engine and hadn't had a fire, he still could have continued to fly on one engine, but then he would have put out a pan that he had a fire and he wanted to divert. And there's no message from the aircraft at all.
Malaysia says it's sending naval ships and a C-130 aircraft to help with the search, while Singapore has also sent a C-130. Australia has also offered its help. It's the third major plane crash involving an Asian carrier this year. Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 has yet to be found, and flight MH17 from the same airline exploded over Ukraine in July, killing 298 people.
Michael Edwards. Rescue services from 3 countries are battling treacherous weather conditions to try and save hundreds of people trapped in a burning ferry in the Adriatic Sea off Greece. Desperate passengers huddled and freezing on the top deck have even resorted to calling Greek TV stations to plead for their rescue. At last report, one person has died and more than 300 people remain on board in what the Greek Coast Guard is calling a superhuman effort by rescue crews. Europe correspondent Mary Geeran reports.
In the quiet early hours of Monday morning, most people on board the ferry, named the Norman Atlantic, were sleeping on their way from Patras in Greece to Ancona in Italy, when fire broke out in the car deck. Dramatic scenes were to follow. Hundreds of passengers tried to find safety as flames spread below them and smoke billowed. Stranded on a ship buffeted by winds of more than 100 kilometres an hour, rocked by 6-metre waves, now adrift in the Adriatic. One of the passengers, Rania Firiou, phoned the Greek TV station Mega, saying there was panic, that she got to the lifeboat station, but there the floor began to burn from the fire below, so she fled to an upper deck. Passenger Nikos Papathiodosiou says the ferry is burning and rudderless. He says the passengers are battling against hail, rain and cold wind, and no other ships are approaching them. One of the ship's cooks reportedly called his wife saying he couldn't breathe, that we're all going to burn like rats, God save us. Those huddled on the top deck included children and the elderly. In such dire conditions, the rescue operation was always going to be difficult. A Greek army helicopter tried to pluck passengers to safety, but at least two dropped into the freezing rough waters. It's not known if they were rescued. Greek shipping minister Miltiadis Vavitsiotis said we are doing everything we can to save those on board and no one will be left helpless in this tough situation. It's one of the most complicated rescue operations we've ever done and multiple forces are needed. Albanian authorities joined the rescue effort. Seven merchant vessels gathered round the ferry to try to block the gale force winds as four Greek and Italian firefighting vessels made their way to the scene, as well as an Italian Coast Guard boat and a Greek military transport plane. Authorities were racing to rescue all on board before nightfall, conscious the fire was raging on a deck with dozens of cars and lorries and up to two dozen container lorries carrying olive oil. Rough seas and thick fog had already led to a collision nearby of two merchant ships, resulting in at least one death. It seems many on board the ferry have reached safety after a long ordeal. Dozens were transferred to a rescue boat, taking them to a nearby container ship. Others have been flown to an Italian military airport, avoiding what could have been a far greater holiday season tragedy. This is Mary Guerin for AM.
Today marks a year since the Al Jazeera journalist Peter Grester was locked up in Egypt for seemingly just doing his job. The Australian and his colleagues, Egyptian Baher Mohamed and Canadian-Egyptian Mohamed Fahmy, were convicted of aiding the banned Muslim Brotherhood group. But their trial was criticised widely for lacking any credible evidence. Peter Grester's parents, Lois and Juris Grester, are renewing their plea for his release ahead of an appeal on New Year's Day. Middle East correspondent Matt Brown reports.
For a year, Peter Grester's mother and father, Lois and Juris, have held on to hope. This Christmas, they were able to visit him in his cell for what Juris says was a happy but not merry time. Their son's Christmas message, published around the world, championing press freedom, displayed extraordinary resolve. A resolve, Juris says, is driven by a deep reserve of resilience and strength.
His Buddhist reading has helped him with the idea of living day by day, rather than conjecturing any number of future outcomes, which we really don't know where any one of them will end. So really that is the basis of his way of dealing with the situation.
Lois Grester says Peter's doing his best to stay positive in the face of the terrible realities of life behind bars in Egypt.
The way he keeps himself busy with his university studies and his meditation and his exercise and his the bit of cooking that he can do are the things that sort of stimulate him, keep him going and not dwelling on the other side of the coin, which is the difficult side and the loss of freedom, etc.
As Peter Grester and his Al Jazeera colleagues, Mohamed Fahmy and Baher Mohamed, prepared for their appeal later this week, there was positive news, enough to buoy hopes they could be released. Al Jazeera is funded by the Gulf state of Qatar, a strategic rival to Egypt, and there have been numerous signs of a thaw in relations between the two. Egypt has accused Al Jazeera of stoking unrest and backing the Muslim Brotherhood. It's an incendiary issue because the Brotherhood has been declared a banned terrorist organisation since the Egyptian military ousted its leader, Mohamed Morsi, from the presidency last year. But in the last few months, Qatar has ejected senior Brotherhood figures it was hosting. Less than 2 weeks ago, it sat down to Saudi brokered talks with Egypt. Then, just 2 days before Christmas, Al Jazeera canned its Mubshir Misr station, dedicated to covering and, many say, criticising Egypt. But Lois Grester says her son is trying not to get his hopes up.
One of the things that he's trying not to do is to spend too much time dwelling on the appeal, because the difficulty of getting too hopeful and then finding it cut underneath his feet is truly devastating. And he did talk about the fact of how difficult it was when the verdict came down, and that he had to face the thought of 7 years in prison.
While it's an agonising process, the two parents are hoping soon justice will be done.
We do have confidence in the integrity of the Egyptian appeals system in reaching what to us is only one possible decision, and that is to overturn the verdict
and
let all three of them free. As to Peter, he was in the country only for 3 weeks. He has had no previous or current interest in Egyptian politics. He has done no harm to Egypt, and the only appropriate thing is to establish his freedom and integrity.
The appeal will be heard on New Year's Day.
Middle East correspondent Matt Brown. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 21 and a half minutes past seven. Parts of southern Queensland and far north New South Wales have received a drenching over the last 24 hours. More than 100 millimetres of rain has fallen in some areas close to Charleville in Queensland. The downpour could herald good news for farmers in parts of drought-affected areas in western Queensland. They're hoping it could be the onset of a monsoon, something that occurs most summers but not for the past 2 years. Queensland farmer Andrew Pegler says his house dam is full for the first time since 2012. He spoke to AM's Bridget Brennan.
Yeah, the house dam's full. It's the first time since 2012 that it's full. We've had some water run into it at a couple of occasions, but we haven't had it full since then.
Can you describe some of the conditions you've seen over the last 2 years?
The last 2 years we've had kangaroos in plague proportions and very little rain, and most of the rain has been in very small falls where we just simply didn't get much response. We haven't got many stock left. We got rid of a lot of stock in March 2013, and we've got very, very few stock left, and the stock we have got left we have been supplementary feeding on a regular basis.
Will any of this recent rainfall help you out?
Look, it will help. It's certainly given us water in our house dam. The biggest thing that it will do is that it will give us short-term feed. It'll let the stock get certainly a lot stronger. But I don't expect a lot of grass growth from this rain. With a country this dry, it's going to need a couple of rainfall events like this to get a body of feed back again, but it's certainly a good start.
What's the morale been like in your area over the last 2 years?
The drought gets everyone down. There's no doubt about that, and I'm not sure why, but this drought seemed to has had a bigger impact, I believe, on people's spirits and than any previous drought that I've seen. I'm not sure why that is. We've had droughts that have gone on longer in the past, but this drought really seems to have got a lot of people very down.
Isisford farmer Andrew Pegler speaking to AM's Bridget Brennan. A contest between a ballerina and a beast. That's how the owner of the US Supermaxi Comanche has explained his boat's defeat by Wild Oats 11 in the Sydney to Hobart yacht race over the weekend. Comanche led the fleet out of Sydney Harbour on Boxing Day, but it was the lithe frame and clever tactics of Wild Oats which helped the Australian Supermaxi to its eighth win in the big race. Reporter Felicity Ogilvie was at the finish line at Constitution Dock in Hobart.
Give them a big hand. There they go. Wild Oats 11 is over.
8 wins makes the Supermaxi the most successful yacht to race in the Sydney to Hobart. Skipper Mark Richards says this win is the sweetest.
Yeah, to win a Hobart is just such a great honour, but to win an eighth Hobart, I just can't believe it, so it's just wonderful.
The skipper says the skill of their navigator was a key reason why Wild Oats made it to Hobart at the front of the fleet.
Yeah, our navigator, Juan Vila, was absolutely phenomenal and absolutely spot on. I mean, he estimated our time at Tasman Light missed out by about 3 minutes.
The owner of Wild Oats, Bob Oatley, was waiting on Constitution Dock for the yacht to arrive. And he was planning his celebration.
Have a drink, I suppose. Normal thing.
A very tight race for the American boat, the Comanche. Were you worried that they were going to beat Wild Oats?
This race is such a lottery. It's very hard to win because of the changing conditions. Never know what's going to happen behind you. You know, you can fall into a hole and a boat will come up and sail past you.
Wild Oats overtook Comanche on the second day of the race when the yachts encountered a high-pressure ridge of weather that slowed down the Supermaxis. Comanche is owned by US entrepreneur Jim Clark and his wife Christy Hinz Clark, a former supermodel from Australia.
We went through a spot where there was absolutely basically no wind.
That boat is like a ballerina and we're a beast.
Have you decided if the beast will be back for another Sydney to Hobart?
I haven't figured it out yet. I need to talk to the crew and find out. I mean, this is quite a ways from everything else, so it's a bit of a chore to come down here. It takes you out of quite a bit of racing elsewhere.
If it's not racing again next year, Comanche will be back to recontest the Sydney to Hobart in 2016.
Felicity Ogilvie. On the face of it, a small outback community in Australia and the bustling streets of Vietnam have very little in common. But students at an innovative Indigenous boarding school in South Australia are jumping from one to the other. The teenagers are all from small communities in the APY lands around Alice Springs, and they have chosen to volunteer in Vietnam. Natalie Whiting reports.
Kieran Van Horen is from the community of Kenmore Park in South Australia's remote APY lands. But he's taking a trip to a very different place, Vietnam.
I'll be going down with a couple of my friends to volunteer and build a house for our family.
Despite the possible culture shock, he says he's not nervous, just excited.
That'll be my first time overseas, and it'll be my first time getting on a big plane as well.
He's one of six students from the Wiltshire Boarding School in Adelaide who will be going. The innovative school for children from remote Indigenous communities has just celebrated its biggest ever graduating class. Eight students this year finished Year 12. All of the students going to Vietnam are completing their Gold Duke of Edinburgh Awards.
For these kids, I guess it's an opportunity that not a lot of their cousins or brothers and sisters might necessarily have. One of the boys last year was saying, I really want to travel again and, you know, this is the kind of thing I could see myself doing. And he'll go home and tell that to his family and hopefully get other people involved. The more that happens, the more people from all around the world can just interact a bit more and understand each other a bit better, and it's a good thing.
Teacher Daniel Bleeby took a group of students over last year as a trial, which the school says was very successful.
The first couple of days there were a lot of kind of open mouth stares as they took in an incredibly different world around them. But as time went on, some of the really beautiful things were seeing them build relationships with the Vietnamese volunteers that we were working with as well, and the kids that were in the orphanage and in the disability centre.
After the pilot last year, the school is now starting a relationship with a Vietnamese community. Janine Tillmouth lives in Nguala, northeast of Alice Springs. She'll be the first person from her community to go overseas.
They're a bit scared that I'm going overseas because it's too far.
What are you most looking forward to?
Meeting new people.
Mr. Bleeby says the cultural exchange goes both ways.
A lot of people in Vietnam really didn't know anything about Aboriginal people in Australia. To hear Vietnamese people speaking Pidgin Data in Hanoi is a very unique experience, but it's a really nice one.
Teacher Daniel Bleeby ending that report from Natalie Whiting. And you can hear more about the Wiltshire School and its students in a radio documentary special after the 5 p.m. news on RN this afternoon. On the financial markets, and the dollar is buying 81.24 US cents, that's down 0.04 on Friday's close. It's buying 66.69 euro cents and 97.78 Japanese yen. Spot gold is trading at $1,336.08 US, up 33 cents. That's the program for today. I'm Simon Santo.